Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's good to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. Now I'd like to continue on with our study of the web of debt, which is the shocking truth about our money system and ultimately how we can break free. It's by Ellen Hodgson Brown, an attorney, and is the textbook for a series of shows in which I go into depth about the history of debt in America with some very interesting investigations into debt creation problems. To start out, I want to give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Ellen Brown, and I highly recommend that you read her works, including The Web of Debt. I believe she's the author of 11 books. To get back into the discussion in The Web of Debt, we were getting some lessons from, believe it or not, The Wizard of Oz by Frank Baum. And it is called The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, a book written at the turn of the 19th century. And as we all know, was later made into a very popular movie. By way of review, the story begins on a barren Kansas farm, where Dorothy lives with a very sober aunt and uncle who never laughed. And this is referring to the 1890s depression that hit the farmers particularly hard. A cyclone comes up, carrying Dorothy and the farmhouse into the magical world of Oz, which represents the American dream that might have been. The house, as you recall, lands on the Wicked Witch of the East, which represented the Wall Street bankers and their man, Grover Cleveland, who kept the Munchkins, the farmers and factory workers, in bondage for many years. For killing the Wicked Witch, Dorothy is awarded magic silver slippers, which was the populist silver solution to the money crisis. She was given the slippers by the Good Witch of the North, and the North represented the populist stronghold. Now, this is the book version. Remember, in the movie, the silver slippers were made into ruby slippers, and the monetary imagery of Baum was lost because the silver shoes had the magic power to solve Dorothy's dilemma, just as the Silverites thought that expanding the money supply with silver coins would solve the problems facing the farmers. Dorothy wanted to get back to Kansas, but was unaware of the power of the slippers on her feet, so she set out for the Emerald City to seek help from the Wizard of Oz, who apparently represented the all-powerful president, whose strings were actually pulled by financiers concealed behind a curtain. The road to the City of Emeralds is paved with yellow brick, she was told, so you cannot miss it. And it turns out that Baum's contemporary audience could not miss it either, as an allusion to the gold standard that was then the hot topic of debate. Like the Emerald City and the great and powerful Oz himself, the yellow brick road would turn out to be an illusion. In the end, what would carry Dorothy home were silver slippers. Now, as we all remember, on her journey down the road made of yellow brick, Dorothy was first joined by the Scarecrow in search of a brain. That is the naive but intelligent farmer kept in the dark about the government's financial policies. And then the Woodman, the Tin Woodman, in search of a heart, who represented the factory worker frozen by unemployment and dehumanized by mechanization. The Tin Woodman was put under the spell by the Witch of the East. Once independent and hardworking, he ultimately found that every time he swung the axe, it chopped off a different part of his body. You don't see this in the movie, but this is the book. Knowing no other trade, he worked harder than ever. For luckily, in Oz, tinsmiths can repair such things. Soon, the woodman was all tin. In this way, Eastern witchcraft dehumanized a simple laborer so that the faster and better he worked, the more quickly he became a kind of machine. This is a populist view of evil Eastern influences on honest labor, which could hardly be more pointed. The Eastern witchcraft that had caused the woodman to chop off parts of his own body reflected the dark magic of the Wall Street bankers, whose gold standard allowed less money into the system than was collectively owed to the banks, causing the assets of the laboring classes to be systematically devoured by debt. Also, you'll remember that there was a fourth character to join the march on Oz, and that was the Lion in search of courage. The Lion represented the orator William Jennings Bryan himself, whose roar was mighty like the king of the forest, but who lacked political power. Bryan was branded a coward by his opponents because he was a pacifist and anti-imperialist at a time of American expansion in Asia. If you recall again, the Lion became entranced and fell asleep in the witch's poppy field, suggesting Bryan's tendency to get sidetracked with issues of American imperialism stemming from the Opium Wars. Since Byron led the Populist or People's Party, the Lion also represented the people, collectively powerful, but entranced and unaware of their strength. In the Emerald City, when they arrived, people were required to wear green-colored glasses attached by a gold buckle, suggesting green paper money shackled to the gold standard. To get to her room in the Emerald Palace, Dorothy had to go through 7 passages and up 3 flights of stairs, an allusion to the crime of 73. That was the 1873 act that changed the money system from bimetallism, paper notes backed by both gold and silver, to an exclusive gold standard. This act was proof to all populists that Congress and the bankers were in collusion. Dorothy and her troop presented their request to the wizard, who demanded that they first vanquish the Wicked Witch of the West. Who was the Wicked Witch of the West? Well, that character represented the McKinley-Rockefeller faction in Ohio, then considered a Western state. The financial powers of the day were the Morgan, Wall Street, Cleveland faction in the East, the Wicked Witch of the East, and this Rockefeller-backed contingent from Ohio, the state of McKinley, Marcus Hanna, and the Rockefeller Standard Oil Cartel. Hanna was an industrialist who was a high school friend of John D. Rockefeller and had the financial backing of the oil giant. So I'll continue in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, continuing the parallel analysis between the Wonderful Wizard of Oz and the banking powers around 1890 through 1900, which it represents, Dorothy and her friends learned that the Wicked Witch of the West had enslaved the Yellow Winkies and the Winged Monkeys, which is an allusion to the Chinese immigrants working on the Union Pacific Railroad, the Native Americans banished from the northern woods, and the Filipinos denied independence by McKinley. Dorothy ultimately destroyed the witch by melting her with a bucket of water, suggesting the rain that would reverse the drought, as well as the financial liquidity that the populist solution would bring to the land. As one 19th century commentator put it, money and debt are as opposite in nature as fire and water. Money extinguishes debt as water extinguishes fire. When Dorothy and her troop got lost in the forest, she was told to call the winged monkeys by using a golden cap she had found in the witch's cupboard. When the winged monkeys came, their leader explained that they were once a free and happy people, but they were now three times the slaves of the owner of the golden cap, whoever he may be, which represented the bankers and their gold standard. When the gold cap fell into the hands of the Wicked Witch of the West, the witch made them enslave the Winkies and drive Oz himself from the land of the West. Dorothy used the power of the cap to have her band of pilgrims flown to the Emerald City, where they discovered that the wizard was only a smoke and mirrors illusion operated by a little man behind a curtain. A dispossessed Nebraska man himself, he admitted to being a humbug without real power. "One of my greatest fears was the witches," he said, "for while I had no magical powers at all, I soon found out that the witches were really able to do wonderful things." If the wizard and his puppet were Marcus Hanna and William McKinley, who were the witches they feared? Behind the Wall Street bankers were powerful British financiers who had been trying to divide and conquer America economically for over a century. Patriotic Americans had regarded the British as the enemy ever since the American Revolution. McKinley was a protectionist who favored high tariffs to keep these marauding British free traders out. When he was assassinated in 1901, no conspiracy was proved, but some suspicious commentators saw the invisible hand of British high finance at work. Although the wizard lacked magical powers, he was a very good psychologist who showed the petitioners that they had the power to solve their own problems and manifest their own dreams. The scarecrow just needed a paper diploma to realize that he had a brain. For the Tin Woodman, it was a silk heart. For the lion, an elixir for courage. The wizard offered to take Dorothy back to Kansas in the hot air balloon in which he had arrived years earlier, but the balloon took off before she could get on board. Dorothy and her friends then set out to find Glinda, the Good Witch of the South, who they were told could help Dorothy find her way home. On the way, they faced various challenges, including a great spider that ate everything in its path and kept everyone unsafe as long as it was alive. The lion, as you remember, the populist leader William Jennings Bryan, welcomed this chance to test his newfound courage and prove he was indeed the king of the beasts. He decapitated the mighty spider with his paw, just as Bryan would have toppled the banking cartel if he had won the presidency, which unfortunately he did not. The group finally reached Glinda, who revealed that Dorothy too had the magic tokens she needed all along. The silver shoes on her feet would take her home. "But first," said Glinda, "Dorothy must give up the golden cap, the banker's restrictive gold standard that had enslaved the people." The moral also worked for the nation itself. The economy was deep in depression, but the country's farmlands were still fertile and its factories were ready to roll. Its entranced people merely lacked the paper tokens called money that would facilitate production and trade. The people had been deluded into a belief in scarcity by defining their wealth in terms of a scarce commodity, gold. Now, this is really a critical point in the whole book and what we're going to continue to discuss. So it bears repeating. The people had been deluded into a belief in scarcity by defining their wealth in terms of a scarce commodity, gold. The country's true wealth consisted of its goods and services, its resources, and the creativity of its people. And that is still true today and will always be true. Goods and services, resources, and creativity are the actual real wealth of any nation. Like the Tin Woodman in need of oil, all it needed was a monetary medium that would allow this wealth to flow freely, circulating from the government to the people and back again, without being perpetually siphoned off into the private coffers of the bankers. Now, the point is that was happening then, and it's happening still today. This perpetual siphoning off of wealth into the private coffers of the private bankers. Historically, when we look back, the populists did not achieve their goals, but they did prove that a third party could influence national politics and generate legislation. Although Bryan and the Lion failed to stop the bankers, greenbacker Jacob Coxey was still on the march. In a plot twist that would be considered contrived if it were fiction, he reappeared on the scene in the 1930s to run against Franklin D. Roosevelt for president at a time when the money question had again become a burning issue. In 1 5-year period, over 2,000 schemes for monetary reform were advanced. Needless to say, Coxey lost the election, but he claimed that his greenback proposal was the model for the New Deal, Roosevelt's plan for putting the unemployed to work on government projects to pull the country out of the Depression. The difference was that Coxey's plan would have been funded with debt-free currency issued by the government on President Lincoln's greenback model. Roosevelt funded the New Deal with borrowed money, which is in contradistinction to greenback money, which is created by and controlled by the government, not by private banks from which the government borrows the money. So Roosevelt funding the New Deal with borrowed money indebted the country to a banking cartel that was surreptitiously creating the money out of thin air, just as the government itself would have been doing under Coxey's plan without accruing a crippling debt to the banks, which is where we are still today, but at the edge of reality in terms of debt. It's so astronomical, it's just numbers on a computer screen, but it ultimately controls, directs, and hampers every other level of our social functioning and economic stability, not only here in the United States, but frankly, everywhere in the world. And we'll see this as the plot unfolds. After World War II, the money question faded into obscurity. Today, writes British economist Michael Robotham, the surest way to ruin a promising career in economics, whether professional or academic, is to venture into the cranks and crackpot world of suggestions for reform of the financial system. Yet the claims of these cranks and crackpots have consistently proven to be correct. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The U.S. debt burden has mushroomed out of control until just the interest on the federal debt now threatens to be a greater tax burden than taxpayers can afford. And for many people, we've reached this some while ago. The gold standard precipitated the problem, but unbuckling the dollar from gold did not solve it. Rather, it caused worse financial ills, expanding the money supply with increasing amounts of easy bank credit. Just put increasing amounts of money in the bankers' pockets, while consumers sank further into debt. The problem has proven to be something more fundamental. It is in who extends the nation's credit. As long as the money supply is created as a debt owed to private banks with interest, the nation's wealth will continue to be drained off into private vaults, leaving scarcity in its wake. So this is really the nub, the focus of the problem. It's not just the credit, it's who is extending the credit. Private banks. Today's money allegory goes something like this, which is a sequel to Oz. The dollar is a national resource that belongs to the people. It was an original invention of the early American colonists, a new form of paper currency backed by the full faith and credit of the people. That's the founding father creation. But a private banking cartel has taken over its issuance, turning debt into money and demanding that it be paid back with interest. Taxes and crushing federal debt have been imposed by a financial ruling class that keeps the people entranced and enslaved. In the happy storybook ending, the power to create money is returned to the people and abundance returns to the land. That's the Wizard of Oz. But before we get there, the yellow brick road takes us through many twists and turns of history and the writings and insights of a wealth of key players. So we'll continue and be off to see the wizard in this rather intriguing expose. So we get into the next chapter, Behind the Curtain, the Federal Reserve and the Federal Debt. And this comes from the film of The Wizard of Oz. Orders are nobody can see the great Oz. Not nobody, not know-how. He's in conference with himself on account of this trouble with the witch. And even if he wasn't, you wouldn't have been able to see him anyway on account of nobody has, not even us in the palace. And that's the guardian of the gates at the Emerald City. Now, the Federal Reserve did not exist when Frank Baum wrote The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, but the book's image of an all-too-human wizard acting behind a curtain of secrecy has been a favorite metaphor for the Fed's illustrious chairman, who has been called the world's most powerful banker. Unlike the U.S. president, who must worry about re-election every 4 years and can serve only 2 terms, the head of the Fed can be reappointed indefinitely and answers to no one. Alan Greenspan served for more than 18 years under 4 presidents before he retired. In a 2001 article titled Greenspan, Financial Wizard of Oz, journalist Paul Sperry wrote of that long-standing chairman, "You may think that Congress and therefore the people can control him. But all lawmakers can do is call him to testify periodically. The hearings are an excuse in futility, not accountability, because Greenspan just obfuscates till everyone is bored silly. You may think that the press can pin him down. In fact, we have no access to him. No press conferences or interviews are allowed. The high priest is untouchable in his marble temple here on Constitution Avenue." And Sperry continued by quoting another Fed watcher who remarked, "Here's this guy projecting this huge brain and everyone's in awe of him. But pull back the curtain and there's just this little man frantically pulling at levers to maintain the image of an intellectual giant." Well, why is it necessary for the Federal Reserve to act behind a curtain of secrecy, independent of congressional oversight and control? Supposedly, it is so the Fed can take actions that are in the best interest of the economy, although they might be unpopular with voters. But as Wright Patman, chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, pointed out in the 1960s, Congress makes decisions every day that are unpopular, including raising taxes, cutting programs, and increasing expenditures, yet it does so after open debate in the democratic way. Why can't the Fed's chairman, who doesn't even have to worry about re-election, lay his cards on the table in the same way? The Wizard of Oz could no doubt have answered that question. The whole money game is a sleight of hand, and it depends on deception to work. Illusion surrounding the Federal Reserve begins with its name. The Federal Reserve is not actually federal, and it keeps no reserves. At least, not in the sense most people think. No gold or silver backs its Federal Reserve notes, which are our dollar bills. A booklet published by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York states, "Currency cannot be redeemed or exchanged for treasury gold or any other asset used as backing. The question of just what assets back Federal Reserve notes has little but bookkeeping significance." The Federal Reserve is commonly called the Fed, confusing it with the U.S. government, but, and here's the surprise for most people, it is actually a private corporation. It is so private that its stock is not even traded on the stock exchange. The government doesn't own it. You and I can't own it. It is owned by a consortium of private banks, the biggest of which are Citibank and J.P. Morgan Chase Company. These two megabanks are the financial cornerstones of the empires built by J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller, the robber barons who orchestrated the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. And as for keeping reserves, Wright Patman decided to see for himself. Having heard that Federal Reserve banks hold large amounts of cash, he visited two regional Federal Reserve banks where he was led into vaults and shown great piles of government securities. Was a government security? It's an IOU representing debt. When he asked to see their cash, the bank official seemed confused. He repeated the request only to be shown some ledgers and bank checks. Later, Patman wrote, "The cash, in truth, does not exist and never has existed. What we call cash reserves are simply bookkeeping credits entered upon the ledgers of the Federal Reserve banks. These credits are created by the Federal Reserve banks and then passed along through the banking system." Well, that raises the question, where did the Federal Reserve get the money to acquire all the government bonds in the vaults? Patman answers his own rhetorical question. It doesn't get money, it creates it. When the Federal Reserve writes a check for a government bond, it does exactly what any bank does. It creates money. It created money purely and simply by writing a check. When the recipient of the check wants cash, then the Federal Reserve can oblige him by printing the cash, Federal Reserve notes, which the check's receiver's commercial bank can hand over to him. The Federal Reserve, in short, is a total money-making machine. So that is where we will end this week, on the point that the Federal Reserve is neither federal, there are no money reserves. It's a private bank that is owned mostly by two mega banks, J.P. Morgan Chase and Citibank, and it doesn't get money, it creates it. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.